Welcome to Forget the Box, the ultimate web series podcast. I'm your host slash terrible community director, Brie Castellini, and today we're talking about talking to people. That's right, we're covering networking. My guest today is Jack Ferry, an independent director and producer with over 15 years of experience from companies like MTV, Nickelodeon, Discovery, IFC, Netflix, and many, many more. He and I cover all the basics of networking, as well as just what to expect when working in this kind of an industry. Also, as a reminder to you filmmakers out there, Stareable Fest 2019 is officially accepting submissions. Early bird pricing only lasts till the end of January, so submit now to make sure that you get the cheapest prices. All right, let's get into the episode. Welcome to Forget the Box.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
So can you tell everybody who you are and what you make?
So my name is Jack Ferry. I am a director, producer. I've done a series of web series recently. I've done podcasts, variety of different kinds of podcasts. But I say, primarily when people ask me what I do, I just say I'm a filmmaker.
Yeah, it's a good kind of catch-all.
Yeah.
I know you did broadcast news for quite a while, yep. And you went to NYU for film. How did you end up kind of going back into the more like what people would consider, quote unquote, the creative side of filmmaking?
Well, I ended up in news kind of by accident. So I went to film school and I was in New York when 9/11 happened. And I had just graduated from school. And so I didn't have a job at the time. Because like my previous job was just like a summer thing. I worked for Shakespeare in the Park.
Oh, cool.
And then, you know, so I was looking for a gig at the time and 9/11 happened and I had done some PA work for, Reuters like a year ago, you know, a year before then. Mm-hmm. So I just kind of reached out and I was like, hey, do you guys need help? And they were like, can you come up tonight? And I started working for them that night. And then it was a interesting experience because it's, you know, obviously it was like probably the biggest news story of so many journalists' careers. And I was like thrust into it as like my very first job. And then I just kind of got caught up in like the excitement of it all. And it was a really good day job while I was pursuing other things. So while I was working, and I was freelance, so I was working for Reuters, but I was also working for like a lot of other companies like BBC, Al Jazeera, and things like that. And I covered the 2008 presidential campaign with Barack Obama and John McCain for RTL German television, which was an interesting experience. But really, it was just a day job. It was just a way to sort of make ends meet. So rather than being a waiter or a bartender or something, I was like, this is something that's a little bit more in my wheelhouse in terms of skills.
Sure.
But I'd always had my sort of other toe in the water of like the creative side of things. So when I'd first graduated, I was trying to get my short film finished from NYU. And that took a couple of years because I needed to like raise money to like, because we'd shot it on film. And
oh, wow.
We needed to transfer the negative to digital so that we could edit it and all that. Like it was expensive and I had to like save and raise money to get there. So I did that. And then I did like the film festival thing. Like we played like 12 different film festivals around the country with that. And then it was interesting because around that same time, like as soon as that run was over and I was like, this was cool. Like I got a lot out of it. I didn't get like a 3-picture deal at, you know, Warner Brothers or anything like that, but it was a great experience and I learned a lot. But then like the following year I had made an internet short, like a comedy sketch with some friends of mine and it just like went viral. And this was in like 2007 and it got like picked up on like a lot of like those places that would like put stuff out, like E-Bombs World, which I'm not even sure people even remember what that was, but it was like one of those things that would like pick up viral videos. And so this video got like 1 million views in a weekend, which for 2007 was like really impressive. So it dawned on me at that moment that I was like, okay, this short film that I had spent years raising money for has been seen by, you know, maybe tens of thousands of people at these film festivals, and that's really it. But then this sketch that I did one weekend for, you know, $40 ended up getting seen by 1 million people. And then some. Like it's in the end, it was like up to like 3.5 million.
Wow.
And yeah. And then so I was like, okay, well, I clearly need to pay attention to the internet because there's no barrier to your audience.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was from there that I was just sort of like, all right, my new focus now is going to be on internet projects. And then from there, I worked on a web series with a friend of mine. show called The Burg, which is about Williamsburg hipsters. I just liked it. I thought it was funny and I wanted to help out. And so I started working with them and then I became friends with them. And then when they got a deal to do their next show, which is called The All For Knots, which was a sort of a mockumentary comedy about a band on the road, they invited me to be the director of photography of that show. And that was for Michael Eisner's company. And it was a co-production with HDNet. So like Mark Cuban was involved. And, you know, and that to me, this was like in 2009. So for me, that was like confirmation that like I'd made the right choice because I went from playing film festivals and not really meeting anybody of import to suddenly being in the same room as, you know, Michael Eisner and Mark Cuban.
Really quickly, what did you concentrate on at NYU? Like when you were going to film school, what did you expect to be doing? Because you've talked about producing, you've talked about director of photography, which aren't necessarily the same path at all. I'm curious.
No, they're not. And I most of the stuff that I do is sort of means to an end. So the producing, the shooting, and the editing is all really to serve my main goal, which is to be a director. That's what I always wanted to do. At NYU, I actually double majored in theater and film.
Okay.
So I have a love for both, but I realized that, you know, film is, there's just more opportunity for me there. And I have a lot of skills that can apply. And most of those skills I learned doing news. Like I learned how to shoot by doing news. I learned how to edit doing news. And I was able to apply those, you know, skills. I learned how to like do field producing in news. And so that all really informed my later career. But the producing is really a means to an end. I don't really have a passion for producing necessarily, but for me, it's like, if I produce this project and I get an opportunity to direct it, then for me, that's worth it.
Totally.
But last year was cool because last year was the first time I got hired on a pretty big show to just direct. And there was no expectation of me to actually like have to produce the thing.
Are you allowed to talk about that?
I can talk about it. It's not out yet. It's called Millennial Mafia. It's a comedy series. Basically, the premise is this giant RICO investigation takes down an entire mafia family all in one day, leaving only their clueless kids to like run their criminal organization.
That's hilarious. Who's making that? Is it a studio or indie?
I did it for Entertainment One, okay. Which I think now is Mark Gordon company. They like merged or something. But anyway, I did it for Entertainment One and it was for Go 90. So it was another one of those shows that was supposed to go on the Verizon app. But since Go 90 shut down, I think Entertainment One is looking to sell it to a different platform. I don't know where it's going to end up. Like I said, I'm not a producer on the project, so I'm not really privy to all that.
Right.
But that was cool because it was like, that was a great opportunity to just go in there and like direct something and not have to worry about like going out there and securing the funding for it. You know, because like my biggest project that I've done so far is I did 4 seasons of a show called Mr. Student Body President also for Go 90, RIP. And that was that. Like I had to go out there and like, no, I had a partner, thankfully. So we were able to like sort of share the work. But like we had to go out there and like try to convince them to give us money to do the pilot. And then after the pilot, they sold the series and we had to like go out there and actually like make the show. And, you know, we were really responsible for every aspect of it. But I would say it was successful. I mean, it was sort of unprecedented that we got a 3-season renewal. Like we went from doing one episode or one season for 10 episodes and they liked it so much. They're like, yeah, we just want 3 more of that.
Wow. Yeah. No, that is impressive. I think Mr. Student Body President was actually a Stairable staff pick at one point. So we were definitely big fans of the show here at Stairable.
Awesome. Thank you.
Cool. So actually, since you mentioned Go 90, RIP, I wanted to ask you about that. So obviously, your current, you know, you're not sure what's going on with this current show, which sounds hilarious. So yeah. I can't wait to hear when that comes out, wherever it may be. But I'm curious your perspective, having kind of worked with a variety of companies, both digital and mainstream, with all of these like recent being the last 2 years, really, digital video layoffs that are happening across the industry with Go 90, Super Deluxe, Funny or Die, Cracked letting go of its whole video team. Do you have any thoughts about sort of what's going on and what it means for indie filmmakers making content in this space currently?
I mean, it's just the ebb and flow of the business. So this has happened before. Like I saw this in like 2006, 2007, there was a shrink. There was like this major boom. Like everyone was like, we got to make web video. And that's when like people like Michael Eisner and these like Hollywood heavy hitters were suddenly like pouring a lot of attention and money into the space. And then like there were all of these companies. Like there was a company called Babbelgum. There was a company called Mania TV. Like there were all of these like internet like video companies and they all just like vanished. I mean, there was a company called Next New Networks, which I had done a show for, like a music video show called $99 Music Videos. Like they were on the verge of like going away, but then they ended up getting bought by Google. So like this is just cyclical. Like this happens. Like there's a boom and a, like Super Deluxe has, this is the second time Super Deluxe has gone away. Like my partner on Mr. and My President, Ryan, had a show on Super Deluxe the first time around and it never came out because after they delivered it, they shut down. And then they like several years later came back and I was like, just like looking at my watch being like, let's see how long this stays open. And then, you know, sure enough, they shut it back down. The thing is like, it's the economics of the internet aren't really conducive to running a robust business yet. And it's still like the Wild West. So like, you know, you've got people complaining a lot about right now about like the YouTube algorithm and how it like punishes people if they don't like post every day. Mm-hmm. And the only people who are really popular right now seem to be like racist white dudes who play video games all day, which, you know, that is a criticism some people make. I don't necessarily make that criticism, but like it is interesting that those tend to be the kind of people that make a lot of money. And so I'm wondering, like, why is it that those guys are so popular and these other people that are like really talented are less so? And so that leads me to believe that there's something going on behind the scenes in terms of like, you know, the algorithm isn't really promoting the most diverse amount of content. Sure. For the consumer. And that is a problem. But I also think it's just the economics of it are all screwed up. Like I made this argument the other day where, or not the other day, a couple months ago, where I had read somewhere that this television show had gotten somewhere around like the one episode of their show had gotten like 1.5 million viewers, but it's like a television show. And I was like, just so you guys, so I can put this in perspective for you guys, if a YouTube video makes 1 million views, on average, it brings in about $1,500 in ad revenue.
Right.
So just do the math. So like, that's a YouTube video that's bringing in 15K or 1500. And then you've got this television show, which that probably wouldn't even cover the catering budget. And it's got roughly the same number of viewers. So somewhere the economics of this are off. Like at some point, I thought it would happen a lot sooner than this. Advertisers would realize, let's say we want to reach 3 million people. It doesn't matter where we reach those 3 million people, but we want to reach 3 million people. Why are we spending 100 times the amount of money just because it's on traditional television? And I think it's just because the industry has just been very, very slow to update itself.
Right.
And also there's a lot of shenanigans going on online where it's like, you know, you can complain about Nielsen, but at least Nielsen is a company that's been around for almost 1 million, or you know, 1 million years. And yes, it's flawed, but at least, you know, it's the devil we know. Versus, you know, how do we know these numbers are accurate? I mean, there was allegations of like
view count fraud from Facebook. Is that what you're thinking of?
From Facebook, yeah, exactly. So because of that, it throws everything off, saying like, okay, well, what is really a view, and is it a view, and is it really getting 1 million views? Then, I mean, how many of these views are bots? You know, how many followers on Twitter do you have that are bots? Like, it gets to a point where, you know, if you're an ad buyer or seller, you're sort of like, at least I know what I'm getting on TV. And so that needs to sort of fix itself. But, you know, again, it's like, it's still, internet video is still very nascent. So I think it has, you know, you have to remember that television's been around for almost 100 years and filmmaking obviously has been around for longer than that. So, you know, we have to like understand that like, these are like the sort of early stages of an industry sort of working out its kinks. We're just now seeing like the first sort of crop of like millionaires mm-hmm. from the internet. I think, you know, that's the thing that sort of starts to change things. Like the film industry didn't really become the film industry until we started having actual movie stars.
Right.
You know? And so I think that's going to start changing things. And I think at a certain point, the audience, too, is going to demand more diversity of content. And I mean, they already kind of are when you look at like Netflix, which is the world's largest provider of web series. At a certain point, people are just going to be frustrated with just like, okay, enough of the video game content. Like, I actually want like a diverse range of stuff to watch.
No, I hope that comes sooner rather than later. So based on sort of your understanding of this, since you also sort of work in the podcasting industry, which I think a lot of people are sort of considering as the next, you know, shiny new thing that everyone wants to get into, advertisers yeah. included, what has been your experience in sort of the similarities and differences between working in web series when they were first starting out and now working in podcasts when it's sort of still a very new burgeoning industry?
Yeah, it's funny because like it is talked about like it's this hot new thing. Mm-hmm.
Even though it's been around for like, 15 years.
Yeah, it's been around for 15 years. It's so funny to me. It's like, well, as you all know, podcasts were started when the show Serial came out. And then, you know, and it's like, we had a show out before that show was even out, you know, but it's like that's suddenly when everyone realized, like, oh, wow, podcasts. It's like any other sort of gold rush where it's like, you know, one show is super successful and then a lot of other shows or people or companies decide, like, I want a piece of that gold. And then they get out there and they realize they're just getting gold dust. They're not actually getting any nuggets. And that's generally what it is. You know, I never got into podcasts because I thought it was like going to make us a lot of money. For me, it was just an opportunity to work with people that I liked. And I knew that I could generate enough money to sort of pay for itself and pay for the staff and make a decent enough profit to justify the bandwidth that it's taking up for me. And then I have another show that we kind of stopped doing because it wasn't justifying the bandwidth it was taking up and it wasn't making enough money. So it's really hit or miss. I mean, like, it's not easy to make a successful podcast. And the most successful podcasts now are really these like hyper-produced Serial type podcasts. And that's not easy to make. But like, if you listen to a show like S-Town, you're like, this guy has been like researching and recording and editing this story, this one story, for years. I can't imagine what that cost. Now, it had, you know, millions of listeners apparently, so it justified itself in the end. But it does lead me to think, like, you know, that's just a very different kind of podcast than what I'm making. So for me, it's like I see podcasts as there's like sort of three waves. So the first wave of podcasts was talk. And that's generally what I do. Two funny people sitting down having a conversation. So that could be they're talking about movies. It could be they're giving advice to people that are, you know, calling in or writing in asking for advice. Or they're just like talking about their careers, but in a funny way.
Sure.
You know, that's the majority of what early podcasts were. And to a large extent, that's still what it is. Like a lot of very successful podcasts are still that. Like if you look at WTF with Marc Maron, mm-hmm. or like the Joe Rogan podcast, it's, you know, it's funny people talking. The second wave of that was sort of like the This American Lifing of podcasts, where you get shows like Serial. That idea of like, let's do a highly produced radio show, but let's release it exclusively on the internet. That's sort of the second wave, and that's sort of like the hotness that's going on right now. Like, that's what, you know, is getting the most listeners. And it makes sense because at a certain point, like, your audience is like, I want to listen to higher quality content for my time because there's so much more to choose from. The third wave of podcasts, I think, is the thing that's going to be, we're going to see more of soon, is fiction, because I think no one's really figured it out yet, mm-hmm. but there's a lot of experimentation. Audiobooks, as you know, are very popular. I'm an Audible subscriber and I love listening to audiobooks. So fiction definitely has like its appeal, but no one's really mastered it yet on podcasts. Mm-hmm. And I think that could potentially be the next thing. But again, the problem with that is, you know, it's an economics problem. Like, it doesn't cost a lot of money to get two funny people to sit down together with some microphones and have a conversation.
Right.
It does cost a lot of money, though, to like have writers and get a bunch of actors and record.
And then Foley, you know, and music cues and all that.
All of that stuff. Yeah. So you have to sort of like do the calculus and decide, like, is this going to pay for itself based on, you know, like what the CPM rates are on, you know, the advertising we're going to do, or if we're making money, you know, being on Stitcher Premium or whatever. You know, how do we sort of justify this? We are going to see some breakout, and we kind of already have. I mean, there is that show that Gimlet put out, the one that's now an Amazon show.
Oh yeah, the one with Julia Roberts.
Homecoming? Yeah. It's called Homecoming. Yeah. That's right. Which, you know, I listened to that show and I thought it was interesting. I didn't think it was great. I didn't think it was bad, but I didn't think it was great. So it's interesting to me that it became like such a big, big television show. Although technically you could argue that it's also a web series because it's released by Amazon.
Yeah. Cool. So I kind of want to transition then into sort of networking, because it sounds like the beginning of your career started with networking.
In the summer of 2000, the Republican National Convention was held in Philadelphia and they needed somebody who knew the area. And I'm from the Philadelphia area. And because my like godfather had gone to Temple University with this guy who now worked at Reuters and who was like, he basically rang up my godfather and was like, hey, I need a PA who knows Philly to drive our journalists around. Who can you recommend? And he recommended me. And so because of that, I made some contacts at Reuters. And it's just this weird serendipity that like then 9/11 happened. I happened to not have a job and I remembered those guys. And so I just called them and I said, can I help?
But an important takeaway from there is, like, you didn't have to call any, like, you know, some people wouldn't think to call and say, hey, do you need help? And I kind of want to dive into that, because I think a lot of, sure, especially indie web series creators tend to feel very isolated. And that's both frustrating and also sometimes, you know, a problem of their own making. And I kind of want to deconstruct that a little bit and give some advice.
Sure.
So the first thing I want to talk about is sort of the goals of networking, because I think a lot of people tend to think of it as, like, I go to a bar, I shake hands with a man, the next day he gives me a job. And I don't think that's generally how, like, a good networking session is.
And that's not what networking should be. I think the other thing, too, I think is people assume that networking is... They look at networking only from the perspective of networking up, of looking at people who are going to, you know, get them a new opportunity that they wouldn't normally get. But the majority of the networking that people are going to do, and the most important networking that you're going to do, is lateral networking. So it's networking with people that are on your level, who can't really offer you anything other than resources and friendship and just a sort of collegiate, hey, did this happen to you too? Like, that's incredibly important. And because the thing is, like, as those people rise up, so do you. You know, I have friends who are my age who, you know, as I was starting as a filmmaker, they were starting as a low-level producer or a low-level network executive kind of track, you know, starting in the mailroom, so to speak. Now, some of those people are like the head of drama at ABC. These are people that are my age now. So, like, I could call that person and say, hey, I have a new show that's perfect for ABC, and I could get a meeting. And it's because I networked laterally. If I had looked at them and said, oh, well, they can't help me, they're just they're in the mailroom, I need to talk to, you know, the head of ABC is not going to talk to me. The head of drama of ABC 20 years ago is not going to talk to me. Even if they did, they're not really going to offer me anything than, like, you know, a kind of entry level thing anyway. So you kind of have to, like, play the long game in that, but also you have to network down as well. There are people, as you become more successful, there are people that are going to reach out to you and ask for advice and help. And you should do that, because, you know, you kind of have to pay back what the industry has given you. So, like, to take my story full circle, when my godfather's son graduated from college, I think he went to Drexel, he reached out and was like, hey, remember when I hooked you up with Reuters? Can you do the same for my kid? And I was like, absolutely. So I did, like, full court press. I, like, went out to, like, all the people that I knew that were working at all the various, you know, companies in New York. And I was like, you know, my cousin needs a job. I need you to, you know, you don't have to promise you're going to hire him, but at the very least, I need you to promise that you'll, like, meet him for a coffee or something.
Right.
Yeah, I got him a job and he still works there. And that's good, because it's like, I'm sort of, like, paying it back, you know, or paying it forward, I guess you could say.
Right.
But also, like, who knows what's going to happen? Like, he could then go off and become a hugely successful producer in his own right, who gives me opportunities years down the road. So you really have to, like, look at it from all three perspectives. And I would say the vast majority of your attention should be put on networking laterally, and just, you know, as much as you're helping people below you, that's how much you should be looking at people above you.
I definitely agree. So I've kind of broken this down into sort of two areas, the, you know, ideas for networking in real life and ideas for networking online, since, you know, a lot of web series creators aren't necessarily in a New York or LA sort of situation, and they tend to have to sort of start online. But let's start with real life, since that's where most of the sort of traditional networking takes place. So we actually have a couple of questions from our filmmaker forum, community.starable.com. So first up, we have a question from Meg, who asks, how do you know what networking events are worth it?
I think it's tough to know what networking events are worth it until you start going to them. There's this sort of theory in the sort of networking that, like, you know, never eat alone, where it's like, hey, you got to eat lunch anyway. You might as well have lunch with somebody, because then you're making connections. Even if that somebody can't necessarily do anything for you, you just never know. You could be setting something up that could really help you out, you know, 3 years from now. So my feeling on it is, if you get invited to a lot of, like, those networking kind of events and you're going to go out anyway, just go to some of them, and you'll know pretty quickly which ones are worthwhile and which ones aren't. And generally, the ones I found that were worthwhile are the ones that were fun. There were a lot of people that I felt like were at my level or slightly higher or slightly lower that, you know, I could, like, hang out with. The majority of, like, networking, I think, is just sort of commiserating with each other, being like, you know, having those conversations where it's like, wow, did you hear about Super Deluxe? Yeah, crazy. You know what I mean? What are you going to do? Like, I had a show there and it's gone now. Oh, that's funny. I had a show at Go90 and it's gone now. What are you going to do? I don't know. What are you going to do? And, like, you know, compare notes.
Sure.
But you're not going to know until you go out and you try some of them. And then at a certain point, you just get a sense of it. And you're just sort of like, oh, yeah, I know what that's going to be. It's going to be some sparsely attended whatever. I don't need to go to that. Or this one was like, oh, no, that's like actually a really fun party. I'm going to go to that one.
Another kind of follow up to that, filmmaker Ollie asks, do you have advice about the actual act of networking in person as someone who doesn't know anyone / is socially awkward? And then he adds on advice that isn't just, quote unquote, suck it up.
Right. Honestly, the best thing you can do if that's the case is to bring a buddy. So in the dating world, it's like a wingman,
right,
or wingwoman. It's the same sort of thing, except, you know, the social interaction is if you make your intention known that, like, I'm trying to, you know, sleep with you, you're going to be met with a lot more resistance than if it's clear that your intention is I want to have a fun and funny conversation for the next 4 minutes.
Right.
You're just going to have a lot more luck. And so I think similarly, when it comes to networking, if you're going into a conversation with like, what can you do for me and what will you do for me versus you seem like a fun person that I want to talk to for the next couple minutes, you're going to have more luck in that conversation, A. And then B, if that's difficult for you to initiate, which it is difficult for a lot of people to initiate, it's difficult to, like, you know, approach random people and in bars and try to pick them up. In which case, that's why it's helpful to have a friend who maybe is a little less socially awkward, who can, you know, then you can kind of tag team it. Then it's like, I'm not going up and introducing myself. I'm going up there to introduce my friend.
Right.
And then your friend does the same. Your friend goes, I'm introducing you to my friend. And really, you only need to know one person at one of these events. And then you could be like, say to them, like, yeah, I don't know anybody here. Who do you know? And be like, oh, I know Jim over there and Eric and Caitlin. And I'd be like, oh, cool. Can you introduce me to them? And generally, they'll be like, oh, yeah, of course, because we're all friends. And then, you know, Caitlin knows somebody that your first person didn't know, and then she's going to introduce you to those new people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's really the key, I think, is you just got to, like, find that, like, one person.
Yeah. I would also say err on the side of asking questions. It's often, like, the hardest part is, like, walking up and, like, saying, hi, I'm Brie Castellini. I am a filmmaker that you should know about. But it's a lot easier to sort of walk up like, hi, you know, I don't really know anybody here. What do? You know, and then just ask them about their work. Eventually, there will probably be an in for you to talk about your own. But, like, if you start out by just asking people questions about themselves, people love answering questions about themselves the same way that you would probably love it if somebody asked you these questions.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think to a certain extent, though, because I have, but there are also times when, like, I've gotten cornered by people where I feel like I'm being interrogated because they're just asking question after question after question. So for me, I actually take a different perspective. My take on it is every interaction that I'm having with somebody, I try to, like, make them smile or make them laugh. And that works. And that's just my approach. But, like, that works everything from, like, trying to pick up a girl who you're potentially interested in asking for her number all the way to just this network executive who may or may not be able to help your career in some way. It takes the pressure off of everything if you're just trying to make people laugh, because then it's like, you know, you're just, like, making small talk and then something comes up and you're just, like, looking for that opportunity to say something silly or funny or witty or whatever. And then at that point, generally, that's when, you know, everyone's sort of loose enough to be like, so what does it you do? Oh, that's cool. And, you know, you can kind of talk about it in a sort of self-effacing way, and they can talk about what they do in a self-effacing way.
That makes sense.
Because the thing that I've discovered is nobody's job is really as glamorous as we might think it might be. You know, and that's the thing, too, is, like, when you network laterally, you know, there are also things that, like, come your way. So, like, I'm friends with this guy, Brett, who's a director, and sometimes he works on stuff, and, like, there are times he'll get, like, offered jobs where he just, like, can't do because he's like, oh, I'm booked up on this, you know, sports thing and I don't really know this world. So he's like, would you be interested? I can make an introduction if you want, because, like, they're looking for somebody. He's not in the position to hire me. In fact, you could argue that he's, like, a competitor of mine because he's also a director who works in the digital space. But we don't treat our relationship that way. It's like an opportunity comes that he can't do. He's like, well, I know this guy is pretty good, so I'm going to recommend him. You're not going to get that unless you're networking laterally.
Totally. And you also have the opportunities to start collaborating with people, even if it's, you know, not like the highest level thing. The best part about being a filmmaker is you always need to be working on something new. So the more people you meet, the more new stuff that you can make with totally new resources and
absolutely
favors you haven't called in yet, which is always good. So final thing about in-person networking that I wanted to talk about is how do you actually, like, follow up and keep in touch with all these people? I mean, I know I have a stack of business cards from a variety of Starable events that, unless they email me with a question, I don't know what to do with. What does that relationship look like from there?
You know, to be honest, I'm pretty bad at that too. So I don't know. I also have like a drawer filled with business cards. And it's hilarious too, because like so many of these business cards, like you go through them and it's like a time like lapse of like, oh, that company doesn't exist anymore. That company, he's not there anymore. Oh yeah, she left a year ago. Often those like numbers and emails, like most of the time you're not going to hear from them until you get that email being like, hey, so today's my last day here. Here's my Gmail. I'll let you know where I land. And then like 3 weeks later, okay, here's my new corporate email at the new company I'm at. I don't know. For me, I don't really feel the need to do much following up. For me, it's just like, I met you, I got to know you, hopefully I made you laugh, and the next event that I see you at, I'll come up to you, try to remind you of the thing that maybe made you laugh. And then it's like, then we're just like seeing each other. And then it's like, if the conversation sort of leads itself, the thing is like a lot of these people, like if there's an opportunity for you there, they find a way to sort of let it be known. It is a lot like dating in that regard, where it's like, if you're meeting somebody and they like, it becomes clear that this person wants to give you their number, that's when it's the time to ask for the number. It's the same sort of thing. Like at a certain point, like the network executive who is not interested is not going to ask you a question like, so what is it you're working on?
Right.
But if they do ask, then you give them the elevator pitch. And if they like it, they'd be like, oh, cool, we should set up a meeting. That's exactly the kind of thing that we're looking at. Or they'll say, oh, we don't really do that kind of stuff, but you should talk to Karen over there at the other side of the room because she's looking for that kind of thing right now. Oh, I don't know Karen. Can you introduce me? Of course. Let's go over there right now. You know, like that's the kind of thing. And then the follow-up is easy because then it's sort of like, you know, per our conversation on Saturday or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, would love to come in and show you more about my, you know, untitled project.
Totally. Yeah. And I also don't think that people should put so much pressure on themselves of like every business card you get, you need to like treat like your new best friend, like they're going to be the best man at your wedding. Like,
oh God, you really shouldn't.
You really shouldn't. The whole point of networking is you're meeting a lot of people like very frequently. And, you know, just like dating, your analogy is great. Like when you know, you know. And so a lot of times what I will do is if I meet somebody that we really hit it off and it seems like, you know, we'd want to work together in the future, or at least stay in touch to potentially work together in the future, we set up a one-on-one drink so that we can get to know each other like as people yeah. rather than just as two heads at a networking event.
Yeah, and that's usually how it goes.
So let's move on to online networking, which I think is a pretty big important step, something that certainly changed my career around, got me the current job that I have. So one of our first filmmaker questions comes from a filmmaker named Amanda, who asks, I absolutely love networking and making new friends, but I have definitely found that online connections equal very little for me. What's your opinion about social networking online versus in real life, and how can it benefit you in terms of actually doing the thing?
Yeah, I kind of agree with her, frankly. Mm-hmm. Not to like poo-poo online networking, because I do think it's important. But for me, it's just, I'm just not skilled at that. I don't really like social media very much, even though it's sort of like a job hazard of mine that I have to kind of like keep it up.
Sure.
I find that it's just difficult for me to sort of stay active on all that stuff. You kind of have to treat like, you know, all of those things like Facebook and LinkedIn and Twitter and all that stuff sort of like the same thing. It's like kind of maintaining your sort of social presence at the party. You don't want to just be the person standing in the corner not saying anything, just lurking. But to me, it's just easier to like wander around and have random conversations with random people at a party versus doing it online. And I do think that there's sort of a disposable sort of feeling about things that happen online.
Sure.
Where it's just, if you're meeting somebody at like a networking event and they're like, cool, we should have coffee next Thursday, it's just different than like,
let's keep tweeting at each other.
Yeah. Maybe that shouldn't be the case, but I think that it is. Like, there's still a little bit of that barrier there. I don't know. I'm less skilled at the online networking, even though I do recognize that it's important, but like, I haven't updated my LinkedIn in like 3 years. I go on Facebook once a year to say thank you for all the birthday wishes, and then I sign back out. Just because I found that to me, it was a productivity time suck. Like, I go on there expecting to do things like be productive, networking, etc. But what ends up happening is you end up watching a lot of like videos and reading a lot of angry political tweets that just like trigger you. So I found that like I need to spend less time on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I think an hour spent on social media, that time is probably better spent working on your project.
Sure.
And if you really do want to network, I think it's better to sort of try to find opportunities in person, because that does still mean something. And I understand that a lot of filmmakers don't live in areas where you can. And I would argue that they should consider doing that, because I do think it's important.
When did you move out to LA?
Well, I moved out to LA 5 years ago.
Okay.
Because I became friends with Grace Helbig in New York. because we were working on a project for My Name Channel together. And she moved out here before me. And then she was like, you got to come out here. There's so much opportunity. And I moved out there. And the first thing that I was doing was her podcast. So that's when we launched the podcast together. And there's a reason we all live in LA, and it's not just the nice weather. It's because you can be around all these people. Now, I'm not saying you have to live in LA, but like, I would say, you know, I've my good friend Mitchell, who is from Ohio, like he's constantly talking about like, if everything goes, shitty, I can always just go back to Ohio. And I was like, no, man, there's nothing for you in Ohio. Like, I know the internet is there and you can live more inexpensively than here, but like, there's opportunities to be had here. There are meetings to have. Like, that it really is important. Like, so you kind of have to, like, find at least your hub. Now, it might not be LA. It might not be New York. But it could be Austin, Texas. It could be Minneapolis. It could, like, there are other, like,
hubs,
places that are sort of certainly like Atlanta. But I'm just saying, like, there are places that, like, you know, Portland is better than living in the middle of nowhere in Oregon.
Sure.
Or at the very least, drivable to Portland is better than middle of nowhere in Oregon.
Right.
Seattle is better than the middle of nowhere in Washington, because there are just going to be more sort of opportunities to, like, you just kind of have to be seen, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can do stuff online, but I just think unless you're like a really big like social media influencer, that impact is just going to be pretty minimal.
Yeah. I will say, though, briefly in defense of online networking, which is something that has worked for me in a lot of ways, I will say that especially at the level that I think a lot of our audience is at, you know, making your first or second series, maybe second season, something like that. A lot of the lateral networking you tend to do is helping out other people on their shows, whether it's being their PA or helping them produce or something like that. And one thing that you can do in online networking is, A, you don't have to just trust that the person you're talking to knows what they're talking about and then later watch their show and realize they're crazy, but you can actually watch the show in real time. So you're like, oh, okay, this person seems cool. But you can also offer services like helping out with social media. That's also an opportunity, especially if that's sort of one of your skill sets versus the sort of shooting and editing like you were talking about. Sometimes people have like online marketing or social media help.
Oh,
that
yeah,
they can
for
offer.
Sure. Yeah. And I don't mean to like poo-poo it because I think it's not viable. It's just not my skill set. I'm just not good with that stuff. But I do agree that like it is important to find your colleagues and help them out in any way you can. Like for me, working on the Berg led to a lot of opportunities. And you know, I just called them and I was just like, I just like what you guys are doing. How can I help out? The first day I worked for them, I was a boom operator. I don't know anything about boom operating, but like they kind of showed me how to do it. And then the following week, they're like, oh, you're like a news cameraman. You can shoot. Cool. Well, we need a cameraman next weekend. And so the next weekend I was shooting for them. You know, a couple months later, I'm their DP on their next project, you know, so just kind of help out any way you can is what I say.
Yeah. And that actually transitions great and sort of already answers a question from a filmmaker named Evie who asks, I network online by keeping an eye out for people posting about projects I might be interested in. This way I'm not intruding. And after I inquire how I can help so that the ball's in their court, is there more I should be doing? But it sounds like that's sort of what you should be doing is like, hey, I'm a fan of your work. How can I help?
That's like the number one thing, I think. If like, I think there's a lot of, because as filmmakers, we tend to be sort of naturally competitive. And you have to understand that like your first impulse isn't always the right impulse. So there are times when like you see somebody, they put out like a new movie or a new show or something, and they're getting a lot of buzz or they're getting a lot of attention or it's just really good. And our initial instinct sometimes is to be like, oh man, I'm so jealous. And like, that's fine to feel that. It's a totally natural thing to feel. But I think then your next step needs to be like, okay, but I'm an evolved human being and this person has their own issues. I'm going to send them a congratulatory note and say, congratulations on the write-up. That's really awesome. I hope it's successful. Let me know if you need any help with anything, whatever. And then alternatively, you know, there are the times when, you know, you look at somebody and like, they're really struggling, but you're a fan of their work or you're a fan of them. And then your initial impulse might be, oh no, this person's just not doing well. Again, like your first instinct, even though that was the first thought that you had, doesn't necessarily mean that that's what you should like lean into. You should then say, okay, but I really like their work and I think they're a good person and I want to help them out. So I'm going to reach out and say like, is there anything I can do to help? And I think those are like the sort of perspectives that you have to take, because it can be a lonely career if you look at everything as sort of like a zero-sum game, like an us versus them, because it's not. Like, if you look at the most successful people in this industry, they've all like helped each other. Like, there's a reason why like James Franco and Seth Rogen are like always doing movies and stuff together. Friends just help their friends, and like they kind of all tend to pull each other up. you kind of have to take that same strategy with everybody and just know that like you are a piece of this larger machine that is this community of filmmakers, and you need to be a good piece.
I like that. So I guess my final prepared question came from a couple of filmmakers, and I'm not sure if there's a good answer, but the question is kind of about, is it ever appropriate to try to network or ask for advice from someone who is quote unquote above you online and on social media? Is there an appropriate way to say like, hey, I'm a huge fan of your work, person who was much more successful than me, can I work with you? Can I help you with your next project? Can I ask you for advice? Like, what do you think that looks like in the best version of it?
I mean, it's tough. Yeah. It's generally speaking, if you're going to do that, you just have to steel yourself to the reality that most likely you're not going to get a response. I get those requests from people and I often feel bad because it's like, well, I'm not hiring interns right now. And this person's emailing me saying, I want to be your intern, but like, I can't. I'm not hiring interns right now. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to like get into it with them either because right. like I'm a busy person. I don't really have time to like field every single query I get. So you just kind of have to like recognize that they're probably not going to respond.
And it's not personal. It's not because you suck.
It's definitely not personal. No, it's never personal. It's just they probably, if they had an opportunity, they probably would respond. But I, you know, generally speaking, these people are successful because they already kind of have the things that they need. I think a much better tactic, again, is like, it's just problematic when you are approached by somebody, regardless of what it is, who it's clear that they want something from you. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example. You're walking down the street, you're passing the grocery store, and there's a person with a clipboard coming up to you and saying, hi, do you have a minute? Do you have a minute to talk about the environment? Do you have a minute to talk about animals? Immediately, you're like, oh, I want to extricate myself from this immediately. Even though you might actually agree with their cause, I've got stuff going on, guys. Like, I just don't have time to talk about this right now. Like, nothing personal. This person is approaching you clearly wanting something. Or like somebody coming up to you and you know they're going to try to sell you their mixtape, or you know they're going to try to get you to give them a dollar or a cigarette or something like that. Like, it just, the dynamic is just, you're on immediately on guard. So I think a much better tactic is to go into every encounter, you know, asking nothing of something. Like what I was saying before about like dating, like if you start talking to somebody and it's clear you're just trying to get their number, that interaction is going to be much more guarded than if you're going in there just trying to like make them smile for 4 minutes and then go about the rest of your evening. You know, maybe we'll hit it off. Maybe we'll exchange numbers. Maybe we won't. Who cares? All I want right now is to have an interesting conversation for the next 4 minutes. It's a totally different dynamic. So I think if you're going to reach out to somebody who's super much more successful than you, I think you just start with just that, which is just like, I really love that last thing you did. Great job. Big fan. And like, leave it at that. Frankly, and if you're looking for a job, there are easier ways to get a job. Like, there are job boards. There's, you know, places like ZipRecruiter or whatever that you can like sign up for. And then once you're in a job, you know, you can sort of network within that job to sort of, you know, rise within the job or within the company and move to other companies. You reaching out to a successful producer saying, is there any way I can help? Probably isn't going to net you anything unless you know for a fact they really do need help. Like when it came to the Berg, I was like, this is a self-financed web series these guys are doing on their own. And I just think it's funny. Everyone's working for free. I'm willing to work for free. Hey, can I help out? You know, but by the way, I'm a professional cameraman, editor, et cetera. Like, I've got skills and I just like what you're doing. So for them, it was just sort of like, okay, cool. Like there's a real sort of value or a reason to respond versus, you know, somebody who's already like very successful. It's just, they kind of have all of the components they needed to be successful already. If you really want to intern from them, then you got to get on those job boards where those kinds of companies are posting about interns because they do come up. You know, so like if you're a fan of Ben Stiller, let's say, and you know, you really want to intern for Ben Stiller, you don't reach out to Ben Stiller on Instagram. You keep an eye on the job boards and you wait for the posting for, you know, Red Hour Films, which is his production company, is looking to hire an intern. And then you apply.
All right. Well, any final advice on navigating this crazy industry we're all trying to break into, networking or anything else?
Generally speaking, it's a war of attrition. So not to say that people who give up, that's a negative thing, because, you know, some people should give up. Some people, it's just like, they're just not cut out for this life. They would be more comfortable with a different kind of job or a different kind of lifestyle. And that's totally fine. Just know that like, that's most of the people that are taking up the jobs and that most of them are going to go away. So if you stick with it, you know, you're going to find success if you just keep at it. But I think it's also important to remember that it's not a meritocracy. It's not the hardest worker is the most successful. And that can be really frustrating for people because it's just sort of like, oh, this guy keeps falling fast, you know, ass backwards into success. Mm-hmm. And here I am busting my tail and I don't. It's like the industry will take as much as you're willing to give it. And it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to give any of it back. So you just kind of have to keep that mindset about it. And then if you do, like I said, like eventually you'll start to make waves. But I think the most important piece of advice I've ever heard was from Steve Martin. And I still think it's the most true, which is just you have to cultivate being so good they can't ignore you. And whatever that is, whether it's I want to be the best camera person I can be, or I want to be the best editor that I can be, or I want to be the best writer, filmmaker, joke writer, whatever it is, I am going to work on that so hard that I'm going to be so good that people can't just ignore me anymore. I have a friend of mine, Mike Falzone, who's a stand-up comedian. Mm-hmm. Something like a year or two ago, he was just sort of like, I'm just going to start going up like every night. I'm just going to go to a different show every night and go up and do my stand-up and just like really hone my craft. And it was amazing. Like I didn't used to believe that someone could become funnier by sheer will. And I was wrong because he became funnier over the course of a year. He became like twice as funny simply because he put the work in. And now he's so funny, he can't be ignored. Like he's booking gigs at like the Comedy Store and things like that. That's sort of the key. It doesn't matter how many hours you put in. No one really cares. All that matters is that like, no, you're good. And you're so good, we can't ignore you. And in fact, we need to get in on this before somebody else does, because that's ultimately the key.
Inspiring words to go out on. So thank you so much, Jack, for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for listening. As always, remember to subscribe to Forget the Box on iTunes and leave a kind review or on your preferred podcasting app. Plus, please tweet about the show. We love when people tweet about the show. And if you tag us at Starable, Stareable, we'll celebrate with you. There will be no new episode next week as it is Christmas. But the week after that, on New Year's Day, we will be uploading a special Starable Forget the Box podcast with the entire Starable team. It'll feature me, founder and CEO Ajay Kishore, head of technical stuff John Langhauser, and head of product Alex Menglide. We'll be chatting about our wild and crazy 2018, our challenges and triumphs from the year, as well as what you can look forward to in the future from Starable. It's our season 2 Forget the Box finale, so make sure to check it out. Thanks so much. Have an awesome holiday season and a great rest of your 2018. And thanks again to Anna Eichenhauer, at Queer German Girl on Twitter, for our theme music.